The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. On this week's episode, which is sponsored by The Nation magazine, where I GT here, am a correspondent for, we're going to be talking about the Gaza so-called ceasefire, and trying to look at, you know, what has been achieved and where do we go from here politically. Now, Donald Trump, interviewed by Fox News, said something interesting. He was asked by the host, do you think you've earned a place in heaven by negotiating a ceasefire? And Trump actually, you know, someone I've often criticized, but on this one point, he said something honest, which he says, you know, like, I don't think I'm going to get into heaven. I'm not heaven bound. And I think that that's true, both with the Gaza ceasefire and perhaps more generally. But the ceasefire, you know, is something a lot of us have been hoping for a long time. And it, you know, I think it accentuates the sort of need for a political solution. To talk about this, I'm very happy to have on Yosef Munir, who's the head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. He's been on the show before. He's a very insightful speaker on these issues. So first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, G. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, so let's just get into this, like, just an overall survey. Like, what do you think, you know, about the ceasefire? Like, what has been achieved? And then maybe talk about, you know, some of the sort of rockiness that we were already seeing in the implementation.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you led off with Trump and his sort of assessment that he's not going to make it through the pearly gates. And that might be his most realistic take that we've heard in quite some time, because what we've seen in, you know, recent days and weeks with his work here in the Middle East is that he thinks he's achieved peace in the Middle East. And he's, you know, had these pretty massive meetings with world leaders in Egypt and the you know, the branding of this entire gathering was peace in the Middle East. And they all gathered in front of these big, bold letters that said peace 2025. And, you know, you would think if you listen to the words of Donald Trump that he's resolved in his language something that's been going on for 3,000 years. But, you know, the reality is, I think, as most honest observers know, that's not what we have here. It's not even remotely close to that. What we do have at best case scenario is a very, very fragile ceasefire agreement that is being challenged every day by the situation on the ground. We've already seen Palestinians being killed by the Israeli military since this so-called ceasefire took effect. We have already seen the Israelis reneging on their obligation to allow the free flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. So this ceasefire, if we can call it that, is not without numerous challenges. And that's really the extent of it. We can't say that it is anything beyond that, certainly not now. At the same time, you know, right now we're not in a place where 100, 150 Palestinians are being killed every single day in Gaza by the Israeli military. That's where we were last week. Mm-hmm. That's where we were before this agreement, right? That's a good thing. I'm glad that happening. And I think the entire world was hoping for that to stop. Are we in a place now where we can move more towards peace? That all depends on many, many different questions that are yet to be answered. And I think one of the most important of them is, how do we look at the past 2 years? And I think there's a lot of people out there, including many of the world leaders who were assembled on a stage along with Donald Trump in Cairo to announce this peace in the Middle East agreement, who would like us to simply turn the page from what has happened, would like us to simply, you know, move on. But, you know, we witnessed genocide for 2 years, mm-hmm. Day in and day out. And anybody who's been paying attention knows precisely what I'm talking about. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the United Nations, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, Holocaust scholars, people who work on genocide issues around the world, Israeli human rights organizations, everybody has acknowledged that this is a genocide.
And yeah, and you know, I would also add to all that, like, this is the general consensus of the sort of, you know, peoples of the world, that, you know, there's polling in the United States, that, like, a plurality of Americans
exactly
think that Israel has committed the genocide.
Exactly.
And I'm look, certainly, in Europe, one would find the same thing, and in, you know, the Middle East, and I suspect in Asia and Africa and Latin America. This is, like, 100%, this is the consensus of the world.
100%. It's not something that's controversial. And honestly, people who deny that at this point are the equivalent of the flat earth society, in my view. But just for the sake of argument, let's just say that that's not the situation. Even if you're not ready to use the G word, and I think most of the world is, given what we've seen, there's no denying that there's been incessant war crimes in Gaza for the last 2 years. I mean, that is the most generous, best case scenario. How do you move on from that? How do you just pretend that that didn't happen? What kind of world are we going to live in where we say that that's okay, that there is no accountability for this, that the leaders who calculated these policies, like Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court for the war crime of using starvation as a weapon of war, how do we go on living in a world where he just gets to walk free, where the people who carried out these horrific crimes and posted evidence of it every single day on social media, running over the bodies of Palestinians with tanks, shooting children in the head, blowing up civilian infrastructure, and laughing maniacally about it all at the same time so that their TikTok followers can laugh along with them? How do we just pretend that didn't happen? I think if we're going to have a conversation about whether or not we move from whatever fragile ceasefire we have now to a place that's closer to peace, accountability has to be at the center of that conversation. And any organization, any government who dares speak of human rights, who dares speak of international law or a rules-based order or some kind of norms, if this isn't at the top of their agenda, they cannot be taken seriously. But right now, what we're seeing is most of them just want to move on. And that does not bode well for the future of the region and frankly, for the future of the world. You know, for us to live in a place where what we saw becomes normalized is not just dangerous for Palestinians or the Middle East. It's dangerous for everybody around the world. So, yeah, this is my thinking on it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you raised the issue of accountability, because, I mean, I think it extends broadly. I mean, I think obviously there's the issue of the war crimes of the Netanyahu and his government, and that's still going to be carried through international courts, and that's going to be a process that's going to take many years into the future. But then there's also broader political accountability. I mean, all these acts were supported for the last 2 years by, you know, two American administrations, a bipartisan sort of political consensus. And what is seen, I mean, since you mentioned accountability, a sort of attempt at rehabilitation by certain members of the Biden administration, many of whom have, you know, now been taken up into the arms of the establishment and given all the sort of nice little positions that one gets. I believe Jake Sullivan is at the Harvard Policy School and whatnot. And these people, you know, like, speak very much to your point about, you know, like, for, you know, wanting to move on. You know, like they said, like, you know, we're happy that it's been negotiated. We had tried to do certain things and weren't able to do it. But I mean, like what does it say? If we were talking about the need for accountability, what about the accountability for Anthony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Brett McGurk? Is there anything that can be done about that?
Well, look, I think that the folks that you named, these key architects of Biden administration policy, which, you know, we should be perfectly clear, was a policy that supported this genocide from the beginning and did nothing to stop it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, somehow puts them in an even more pathetic place than the Trump administration, which also supported this genocide for far, far too long. But managed, at least at this point, to get to a ceasefire agreement. We'll see how long it lasts. I hope it does last. But the Biden administration, I mean, what does one even say? I mean, to get, you know, to get outdone by Donald Trump on this issue.
I know
it's a really, really low bar, and somehow they are way below it. And they are, like you said, you know, seeking to sort of whitewash the history here. And I just don't think that could be acceptable. Look, I think there are multiple pathways for accountability, including legally. I mean, you know, these folks, in my view, violated U.S. law.
Yeah.
And that and they should be held to account for that. And they should never be allowed to forget that they did that. And there are lots of ways in which that took place. And frankly, I think in some instances there were conspiracies to violate U.S. law, particularly around evading laws that govern U.S. support for militaries that are denying humanitarian aid. We know that the State Department effectively cooked up a report to say that Israel was not doing what everybody knew that Israel was doing, what every international organization was saying that Israel was doing in denying humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip, which would trigger U.S. laws in relation to arms supplies to Israel, right? And there's a long list of ways in which U.S. laws, I believe, were violated by this administration. But there also needs to be political accountability. I mean, frankly, these folks and people like them, people who have supported this policy, either in positions to shape policy or, you know, just being supportive of that policy from the outside, they should never be welcomed in the Democratic Party again. And I think that's where things are going, to be honest with you. I think people are so outraged by what they saw, so dumbfounded by the way that their government was behaving so differently than they wanted their government to behave in relation to this genocide, that they don't want to see these people ever again. They don't want to see them in positions of power. They don't trust their judgment, and they don't want them representing them.
Yeah, no, I think that is something that is kind of happening. And to be frank, it's kind of surprising to me, like, how quickly it's been happening. I've long thought that, like, at some point, AIPAC would have to be, you know, become like the NRA, like just seen as a toxic lobbying group, and one that lawmakers, certainly if they wanted Democratic Party votes, would not want to be associated with. But now I had frankly thought that this is something that's going to take like 10, 15, 20 years to happen. But suddenly it's like happening at quite a remarkable pace. We talked about this right before we started recording, but Congressman Seth Moulton, who looks to want to do a senatorial run in Massachusetts, very centrist, pro-Israel Democrat, wrote the other day that he will not take AIPAC money. So can we talk a little bit about that, like how the tide is sort of shifting and the way in which, at the very least, AIPAC is being seen as toxic?
That was super, super interesting. I'm glad you raised it. I mean, look, this is a trend that's been happening starting for a while, okay? Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's accelerated a lot because of the genocide over the last couple of years. But, you know, the roots of this, I think, in recent years was in the way in which the Israeli government politicized the U.S.-Israel relationship. Mm-hmm. And the most significant moments around this were really during the Obama administration, where AIPAC, along with the head of the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu, worked alongside Republicans to circumvent the White House and undercut Obama's approach with Iran. And that really identified to Democrats the ways in which this relationship was changing, and that AIPAC was not the kind of bipartisan player that they had once thought they were. And you started to see Democrats start to create some distance between them and AIPAC. it used to be sort of like an annual ritual for all of these different, you know, members of Congress to go speak at the AIPAC event and what have you, people who were running for president and so on. But slowly and slowly, progressive Democrats first and then more mainstream Democrats started to skip some of those AIPAC events and create more distance. So it's been starting for a while. But, you know, we have seen also AIPAC, and it's not just AIPAC, to be fair. There's a number of other organizations that are part of the sort of pro-Israel lobby effort try to fight back against this shift by getting deeply and overtly involved in Democratic primary politics. And so they have sought to primary progressive Democrats who are critical of Israel, who are seeking to hold Israel to account. People, for example, like Congresswoman Cori Bush, people like Jamal Bowman, people like Summer Lee. In some of these cases, they've been successful in supporting primary opponents. Some of these cases, they have not. But they have very directly been involved in basically recruiting candidates and then giving them absurd amounts of money to be able to run these campaigns. I mean, I think in the Missouri one, it was the most expensive primary campaign ever on record. Something like $10 million they spent to try to unseat Cori Bush, right? So this has been sort of the role that they've been playing because, right, they're trying to hold on to an evaporating consensus around this issue. It used to be that they didn't need to really spend money on this stuff in this way. But now, just to hold on to a consensus, they have to spend a significant amount of money, right? But what's so interesting about the Moulton thing is that here you have a Democratic primary, and he's seeking to primary a senator who, you know, as far as, you know, senators on this issue, has been one of the more vocal critics of Israel that are out there. And he has, as you said, he is a centrist, right? Normally, those people would be flocking to AIPAC money to be able to finance their campaigns, right? He starts his campaign now by saying, I don't want anything to do with AIPAC. That's a pretty, we have never seen that before, right? And I should also note, like, even in the years leading up to this, when AIPAC was getting heavily involved in these kinds of primaries, they were getting heavily involved with money, but they were not trying to make their involvement about Israel. So they would spend all this money on campaign ads against the candidate that they wanted to take down, but none of the campaign ads would have anything to do with Israel, because they understood that Democrats are really not interested in hearing a pro-Israel message, right? So, you know, but now we're at a stage, as you said, with Moulton, where here's a centrist Democrat, and even he's saying, AIPAC is too toxic for me, man. And he did this the day after he announced that he was running, right? And when he did it, he said, hey, our FEC filings show that we're not taking any AIPAC money, right? And those FEC filings came out like the day before he made this announcement or something like that, which shows you that actually this was a decision that's been in the works for a while, right? So the ground is shifting actually quite significantly, quite quickly, right beneath all of these politicians' feet. And it's not just happening on the left. It's
that's what
also
I
happening
to come to,
on the right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I mean, I think that like Benjamin Netanyahu, in many ways, is the author of all this. And it was his sort of decision under the Obama administration to basically make the pro-Israel stance a more partisan stance. And I think his thinking was that Israel could always rely on the Republicans. And if they're empowered, they would give Israel what it wants. And the Democrats would be afraid to challenge us. And if they don't like us, it doesn't matter. But I mean, that's turned out to be untrue on both counts. And in the case, you know, they've alienated the Democrats enough that AIPAC money is now seen as toxic. But also, I mean, I think the gamble that he made, that the Republicans are always going to be on their side, that you will always have, because of the Christian evangelical, Christian Zionist component, you'll always have a strong pro-Israel Republican Party. I don't think that's actually been borne out either. And yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's a very significant change.
I think it was a strategy. The idea of putting all of your eggs in the Republican basket was something that was criticized by many pro-Israel folks for some time because they felt that that was risky to begin with.
Yeah.
And I think for some time, you could say that Republicans were reliably pro-Israel and would continue to be. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the thing that really changed that was the MAGA movement. And, you know, political parties go through transformations. I mean, the Republican Party that existed prior to the advent of the MAGA movement was not the Republican Party of the 1950s and 60s, right? The role of evangelicals in Republican politics is a recent development, right? Mm-hmm. It's something over the last 50 years. But just as you know, these waves can come, they also go. And in the process, parties can shift their positions on some of these issues. And so, you know, with the MAGA movement, the key issue here is this question of America first, right? Mm-hmm. It's not really out of love for Palestinians or concern about the rights of Palestinians, but it is a viewpoint that says, why are we giving our money to this foreign country? And how is that in our interest? And if this foreign country is going to keep dragging us into wars and endless entanglements in the Middle East, we're only going to be spending more of our money elsewhere than where we should be spending it, which is here at home, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously, there's lots of other sort of dimensions to this, but that's the basic point, right? And I think one of the things that's happened over the last couple of years is that this question has become really central. Why are we supporting Israel? And people are left to sort of sort that out. They don't understand why we support Israel to the extent that we support Israel, no matter what it does. And when you start asking questions about why, you end up in places where you're thinking a lot about the role of interest groups, where you're thinking a lot about the role of campaign contributions, where you're thinking a lot about a corrupt political system that doesn't seem to be representing the views of the people that it's supposed to represent, which, by the way, reinforces pre-existing MAGA views, right? And reinforces pre-existing views on the left elsewhere, right? Anti-establishment views on the left. And so, you know, the last couple of years have really dragged this into focus. And you have voices on the right now who are really asking questions about why are our politicians taking money from AIPAC, right? Why, you know, why is this organization playing such an influential role in our politics? That's not a question that comes out of concern for Palestinians, right? It comes from a very different place, but it is a question that's being asked more and more and more, and it's led to a lot of resentment. Resentment towards Israel, resentment towards Israel's involvement in American politics, right? And resentment towards politicians, right, who are playing this game, taking money from the interest groups and not really representing the people that they're supposed to represent. I mean, Lindsey Graham is supposed to be the senator from South Carolina, but that guy talks more about Israel than I think he's ever talked about South Carolina, you know? And same goes for Ted Cruz. I mean, you know, when people start thinking about this, they see these things, they say, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up, right? And so, you know, if this genocide had gone on for a month, I don't think we get to that place. But the daily grind, the daily destruction, the imagery led to a lengthy conversation in different corners of the political spectrum about the U.S.-Israel relationship. And we're at a place today that I don't think we were ever before.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the other thing I would say about the right is in some ways, as you mentioned, the evangelical period of domination. And I would also mention also the sort of the role that neoconservatives, former Cold War liberals, who had migrated to the Republican Party, the period of their domination was much more recent and briefer than we would think. It really sort of, you know, coalesced in the 1980s under Reagan and came to fruition under George W. Bush and the global war on terror. And I think in some ways, the failure of that war has, you know, called a lot of the that consensus politics into question within the Republican Party, has made people receptive to other voices, and particularly has revived older traditions. I think people might not be aware of this, but like in the broader sweep of American history, until Reagan, really, the Republicans were the more skeptical party about the Israel relationship than the Democrats were. And it was always like Republican presidents, you know, working from a tradition of sort of national interest realism, who were asking the question, the cost-benefit question, like, what does this alliance get us? And it was like people, so like Eisenhower with the Suez Crisis, or Nixon, or even Reagan with like in Lebanon, who were like, you know, more willing to go against Israel, you know, going as more recently as Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, taking a very strong stance against the settlements. So in some ways, I think the sort of failure of Bush Jr. in the war on terror, combined with this more recent, you know, like genocide and grinding on, and this sort of MAGA question, what is America first, have all caused the ground to shift. And in public opinion polling, that seems to show up, like particularly among young Republicans, like Republicans under, say, you know, 50, who like seem almost as skeptical of Israel as their sort of liberal counterparts. So do you want to say anything about that?
Look, I mean, one thing I think is important to keep in mind is that Benjamin Netanyahu becomes the political operative that he is here in the United States in the 1980s, working in the Israeli embassy during the Reagan years, right? So you can see where this vision and strategy comes from. It comes from an understanding of an American politics that was evolving in that direction during that time, right? Mm-hmm. But that's your parents' Republican Party, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not your parents or my parents, but that's somebody's parents' Republican Party, right? Yeah. That's not the Republican Party of younger Republicans today. And one thing that we see in the public opinion polling around this issue is that it's not just younger Republicans, but also younger evangelicals among those Republicans who are moving away from the pro-Israel position. So what we're really seeing is a generational divide, and it's across the board, right? Across the board, across the spectrum, younger folks are increasingly fed up. And I think you're right to put your finger on, you know, the global war on terror period, which frankly, without the global war on terror and the failures of it, I don't think you get the MAGA movement. Part of the MAGA movement is a resentment towards establishment politics, a resentment towards being lied to. And of course, who they look for to blame for that, right, might be different than who you and I look for to blame for that, right? Mm. They might blame immigrants. They might blame whoever. But the resentment there is real, right? And they don't want to go down the road again of endless wars in the Middle East, right? They're very sensitive to that and angry about it. But I also think, like, you know, we were talking about this in a conversation the other day. There is an Iraq generation, and maybe you and I are part of that Iraq generation for whom, you know, the march to war on Iraq post 9/11 and all of the disastrous lies that went into that were really formative in shaping our understanding of politics for us. There's an entire generation who is the Gaza genocide generation. And these are folks who, for the last 2 years, have been watching day in and day out the horrors that the Israeli military has committed in Gaza and cannot understand why their government here in the United States not just allowed it to happen, but supported it. And that's going to be something that is going to shape their politics for years to come. And I think it's going to change the landscape of what's possible here in terms of U.S. policy on this on this issue. And we're just starting to see the impact of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And there's many areas it's coming through. We mentioned Seth Moulton. I think the New York mayoral race has also been part of this. Certainly Zoran Mamdani has like laid out a sort of non-Zionist position, which was like unthinkable really in the Democratic Party. And now is, you know, on track to being like the mayor of the city, I think, that has like the most number of Jews of any city. Yes. Like,
polling of Israel shows it's, that actually he's doing pretty good with Jewish New Yorkers, you know.
Yeah. I know. Probably going to get like a majority of like certainly younger Jews and getting robustly.
You know, the interesting thing about that whole election, what really is, I think, so consequential about it in terms of the bigger sort of political questions. Mamdani has said a lot of things about this issue. You know, he obviously, he calls it a genocide without equivocating. And he said he would arrest Benjamin Netanyahu if he came to New York, right? And he hasn't paid a political price for this at all.
Quite the reverse. I actually think that like this helped him because it gave 100%. Him a lot of credibility.
And that's what's so different about this. What's so different is that the attacks that used to terrify Democrats, right? The smears of being anti-Semitic or the smears of not being supportive of Israel enough. I mean, there was a time really not that long ago where, I mean, that would end a political career, right? Mm-hmm. And now that's not the case in the biggest city in America with the biggest Jewish population in America. And that sends a message that, you know what, those kinds of attacks, those attack ads, that line just doesn't carry the kind of currency in American politics that it used to. And that means a lot more things are possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, in terms of like sort of laying out, you know, where we might be going, like sort of from here, you know, we mentioned accountability. So I some listeners might remember that moment in 2016, where Hillary Clinton touted her friendship with Henry Kissinger, and Bernie Sanders says, you know, well, like, if I'm president, I will not be calling up Henry Kissinger. He's not my friend. And I can imagine someone running for president in 2028 on the Democratic primary saying, you know, like, when I'm president, Tony Blinken will not be part of my administration. Jake Sullivan will not be part of my administration. Brett McGurk will not be part of my administration. And I would actually recommend that someone running do that, because that's a very clear way of, you know, drawing a line in the sand. I mean, that's like one sort of political consequence. To me, like the other like larger issue is like both what can be done within the political system, but I think more broadly, like outside the political system. Like it seems like the population in the United States and in Europe is far more sickened by what's happened in the Middle East than the elites are. And that working within the political system will get you some necessary results, but like working outside the political system in terms of like boycott, divestment, might yield even more results. But I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think all those efforts are going to continue and really going to grow significantly. I think the only reason we're at a place where there is a ceasefire now, it is because the costs of this genocide were starting to add up for Israel. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech about a month before this ceasefire announcement, where he was speaking in Hebrew before an Israeli audience. And he said, look, like this international isolation thing is real, and we're actually going to have to restructure our economy to deal with it. And we're going to have to engage in independent arms production because we can't really rely on that for the long term, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a person who has a vision for peace, okay? But it's also a person who's saying, we're kind of in deep trouble here, right? And I think that the growing efforts in Europe to call for sanctions of Israel, you know, some European countries have actually been at the forefront of this and doing far more than others. Others have been less willing or comfortable to do that, but particularly after the United Nations General Assembly, when so many European countries recognize the state of Palestine. Now that may not be the thing that, you know, puts sanctions on Israel, but it sends a clear message to Israel, to the Israeli government, to the Israeli people, that those European governments do not see eye to eye with the Israeli government and are getting frustrated and fed up. So what's the next step going to be? If they're at a place where they're recognizing the state of Palestine, what's the next step going to be? They didn't want to wait to find out, right? So I think they started to come to the conclusion that the costs for this genocide were starting to add up. I do want to say something about 2028, though, because I think when I think about 2028, I think about 2008. And the reason that I say that is because in 2008, you know, you ended up seeing Barack Obama get elected in the Democratic primary, which was, you know, not something that people really expected. But one of the key reasons why was because he was able to say, okay, during the Democratic primaries, I oppose the Iraq war. I did not support it. And my foreign policy is going to be different than that. Now, we can talk about whether his foreign policy really was and all the issues with the Obama administration that we ended up seeing for 8 years. But the electorate was pissed about Iraq. And they did not want to reward politicians that they felt were on the wrong side of the most consequential foreign affairs issue of their generation. And I think 2028 is going to shape up much the same way when it comes to the question of, where were you on the Gaza genocide? Who are you going to put around you? I think it's going to be an important issue in the Democratic primary, but I also think it's going to be an important issue on the Republican side as well. Because there's a big debate brewing now among Republicans about what America's position in the world should be and where Israel fits into that. And that's going to break out into the open as we approach 2028.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, I think on the Republican side, one figure to maybe keep an eye out is Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I think once he was roadblocked from running for the Senate, Trump said he wasn't going to support her, has been moving in a very interesting direction and on all sorts of issues. And, you know, she's not someone I would ever support for a wide variety of reasons. But, you know, like on Israel, like he was like basically saying, well, this is a country that has like free healthcare and free college education, and we're like, you know, sending them aid and money. And why? And I think that one reason why Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying that stuff is her next path, if she's not going to go to the Senate, is going to be the presidential run in 2028. And she is like, you know, laying out markers for stuff that she can say that some of her rivals might not be able to say. So it is going to be like a very interesting and contentious period. But I mean, I think there's a lot of hope. And I want to leave maybe listeners with that. I mean, obviously, like what we've seen over the last 2 years, I've been reporting on it and you've been like covering it. And, you know, it's been a very dark and depressing period in many ways, but there is also a path forward, and there's a political path forward. And I think that the sort of struggle continues, and it's also a struggle where I think the people who are on the right side are winning. They're winning hearts and minds every day, and they're changing the conversation every day. And we could be entering into a very different world. So on that very surprisingly optimistic note, I want to thank Yosef Munir once again from the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. For being on the program.
Thank you, Jeet. I look forward to staying in conversation with you as this new world is born.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.